Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we are here in St. Petersburg. That forum that you've been listening to, that long news conference held by some of the most important people in the world and hosted, obviously, by the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, is extremely important for many, many reasons, most certainly because of some of the things that are happening right now in Russia. It's been taking place right there behind me. We're in St. Petersburg. This is one of the most important cities in Europe, by the way. One of the most beautiful cities in Europe as well. And the goal was to be able to have this economic forum in this place, which happens annually, by the way. But for the last couple of years, the ability to attract other countries, leaders like the ones that you were just watching there speaking with Vladimir Putin, has not been as successful as it has been this year. Neither, by the way, has the Russian economy been as successful in being able to catch up because of all the penalties and all the economic sanctions that have been put on it. But on this day, in this place, during this particular forum, the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, we've seen a different sense, a different spirit almost, based on some of the things that are happening in Russia, and also, interestingly enough, some of the things that are happening around the world, most particularly, obviously, because it's the elephant in the room and something that we can't ignore is what's going on right now between Israel and Iran, which obviously is grabbing headlines and grabbing the attention of Vladimir Putin and many of the other leaders. But one of the main focuses that we've been seeing throughout our coverage of this event, not just on this day, but on other days, is leaders from around the world who are coming here, and as you heard there, in a sense, reasserting themselves publicly as friends of Russia, something that we might be able to say they were a little bit shy about doing just a couple of years ago. I think there were a couple of cases here, in fact, where people were asked about secondary sanctions, which is really an important and touchy issue around the world right now, because what the EU, what NATO, and to a certain extent even, but what Washington has suggested it wanted to do more during the Biden administration than during the Trump administration, and this is important, is not just punish Russia. No, they want to punish anybody who does business with Russia. So they're saying to countries like India, you better stop trading in Russian oil and Russian energy, and countries like Indonesia and countries like South Africa. That's why some of this conversation where some of these leaders were put on the record and specifically asked questions about this, where they were asked, what about secondary sanctions? What about these penalties? Would you still stand by Russia if you have secondary penalties? And some of these officials, let me find my glasses, some of these officials were on the record as saying, Bahrain, for example, said, look, we're going to do what we have to do in terms of our relationship with Russia. He said they were going to stay neutral, but we got a sense of what he was saying. South Africa said, we are willing to take sanctions if necessary, if that's what we have to do to continue our friendship with Russia. But, you know, obviously we were watching here Bahrain, Indonesia, China, and South Africa stake their reputations on the ground that they were going to be standing by and doing this. I want to get, first of all, to a couple of important conversations that took place while we were watching this. And I know it's an economic forum, and I know that the economy has a lot to do with this, but once again, the elephant in the room is what's going on elsewhere in the world, Ukraine and obviously Iran. Let's start with Ukraine, because Vladimir Putin was asked a question just a little while ago, and the question was about, and this is something that's come out in the past, what happens if Mr. Zelensky and Ukraine were actually to do this and engage in the usage of, for example, a dirty bomb? You know what a dirty bomb is, where they use just the right types of fission to create not a nuclear bomb, because it's not, but enough that it does enough harm and it's considered to be a weapon of mass destruction. And if he were to do that against Russia, and Vladimir Putin was asked specifically, what would you do if that happened? Here, I want you to hear it, is his answer.
I've read some reports, most of them are in Russian media, that there is an assumption that Ukraine might opt for using a dirty bomb against Russia. Do you take these reports seriously? Do you have intelligence that support this kind of probability?
First of all, it would be a colossal mistake on the part of those we call neo-Nazis in today's Ukraine. It could perhaps be their last mistake, because our nuclear doctrine, along with common sense and our actions, always indicates that we respond to all threats directed at us in kind. We always respond and always mirror the threat. Therefore, our response will be very harsh and likely catastrophic, both for the neo-Nazi regime and, unfortunately, for Ukraine itself. I hope it never comes to that. Thank God we have no confirmations of such intentions. But we proceed from the assumption that such ideas may emerge in someone's sick imagination.
You know, that's an important answer because, you know, putting your stake in the ground, something I mentioned just a little while ago that the other countries are doing about secondary sanctions, it's important for Vladimir Putin to assert that, I guess, as they would say with my friend Che Bowles would say, he's not messing about, right? An expression we've heard in the West in the past, and I think that's the point that he's trying to make. What's the significance of it? Joining me now is my colleague Che Bowles. He's a correspondent. He's been all over the world. He's been following the situation for many, many years. When Vladimir Putin says, don't do this, we're serious. We respect the fact that you want to be a sovereign country, but do not try and mess with us when it comes to this, because we will respond in kind. What's the message he's sending?
Yeah, well, it's not a new message, Rick, right? If you go back to Munich security conferences, this goes back decades. Russia's been warning the West about NATO expansion, about the weaponization of Ukraine. This, even in the aftermath of the Second World War, the CIA and the British Secret Services were pumping money into Ukraine, funding people like Bandera, Shukevich, these guys. So it's nothing new.
Yeah, yeah. But,
and they've been warning about it.
But hold on a minute. There's a difference. In fact, you could make an argument that Vladimir Putin has actually been soft in terms of much of what Russia has received.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
They just had a train derailed.
Yeah.
Terrorism. Mm-hmm. They had terrorists from Ukraine go into the Crocus concert hall and literally kill people. Mm-hmm. They've had generals assassinated on the streets of Moscow. They've had the United States of America in the form of President Biden say it's okay to use cluster ammunitions and use missiles against Russia. So this man has basically sat back and said this whole time, the Russian president has said, you know what? I want to be responsible. I want to moderate the situation. I want to find a peaceful accord. But he's drawing the line right now and saying, all those times, all that crap that you've done to me, I've taken it.
Yeah.
And I'm still trying to find a peaceful solution in Ukraine. But if you go there, it's over. We're using nukes.
Yeah, and people often say in the West, you know, Russia doesn't have any red lines. You know, we can push Russia. People in the EU catch a callous. You know, Russia keeps threatening that it's going to do this, it's going to do that. But that's what they said prior to the Russian intervention in Ukraine itself back in 2022. They said, you know, they always talk, but the Russians did cross the border. They were their hand was forced. And what's happened as a result of that is this Western line has been pushed further and further as Western escalation comes. Remember, ATACMS, from the Javelin missile to ATACMS, it's always been pushed further because the only mode, if you like, of forward motion from the West is actually escalation. And Russia's been, as you say, completely, many Russians even on the street will say, you know, we need to, you know, get a bit tougher with them. But remember, Vladimir Putin is a statesman. And luckily for us that he is, because if he wasn't as statesmanlike and wasn't as, let's say, willing to try and look for peaceful solutions and try to work this out, particularly with the Americans, we could have a catastrophic situation. But of course, this nuclear talk from Zelensky. A year ago, the Times of London published an article saying that Ukraine was months away from creating a bomb. Imagine that. Imagine if Mexico, you know, was being funded by the Chinese and the Russians. A huge army was being built, funded by them. Mm. Americans living on the Mexican side of the border were being attacked, like Russians in Donbass. Imagine what the Americans would have done. Mexico probably would be a desert.
But that's my point. Yeah. My point is, how much can you take? Mm-hmm. And the reason I thought it was significant to hear Vladimir Putin say this in this situation is, here he's being asked a direct question, he's being asked for clarity, and he was as clear as a bell. He was as clear as, I don't think I've seen him be quite as stern as I saw in discussing that. But speaking of clarity, let's go there. Mm-hmm. Something fascinating has just happened that I want to share with you. This is at the UN Security Council. Speaking of clarity, or non-clarity in this case, you know, we just saw Mr. Putin speaking in very clear tones, although, you know, I still think that this session they just did that went like 4 hours could have been done in an hour. So I also thought there was a lot of gibberish going on. But regardless of my opinion, if you really want to see what gibberish looks like, I'm going to show you something now that's going to blow you away. This is at the UN Security Council. The person you're about to hear from is Dorothy Shea. She is the United States Ambassador to the United Nations. And she's trying to make a statement about the United States' position on what's going on in the Middle East, where Israel has attacked Iran. Look what she says.
Israel's government has also spread chaos, terror, and suffering throughout the region. Iran's government has also spread chaos, terror, and suffering throughout the region. Let us not forget that the Iranian government was an enabling and ideological material force behind Hamas's deadly assault on Israel.
Did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
This is the most important news story in the world. It's literally existential. It could bring World War III. We're talking about potentially a nuclear war. And she can't get a sentence out describing, you know, maybe this goes to what you and I were talking about, where I said, you know, here's Putin and the gentleman from Bahrain, Indonesia, China, South Africa, and they're taking all of these questions. They don't even know what the guy's going to ask, and the guy's asking whatever the hell he wants to ask, and they're going on and on and on and on. And I'm thinking, this could never happen in the West. They would have, you know, in your country, in my country, the United States, politicians go out for 10 seconds, 20 seconds, or maybe a minute, have a prepared statement, and then they walk away. Here these guys are sitting here taking questions for 4 hours, and they have no idea what the hell's going to be asked. But they're state TV. They're the controlled media, not the United States and the West. I find it fascinating. But going back to what she said, by the way, Gene, do me a favor, play that again. We need to hear that again, because it's just too freaky, too weird. Play it again.
Israel's government has also spread chaos, terror, and suffering throughout the region. Iran's government has also spread chaos, terror, and suffering throughout the region. Let us not forget that the Iranian government was an enabling and ideological material force behind Hamas's deadly assault on Israel.
Did you see that? She meant to say Iran is spreading chaos and she accidentally said Israel, and then she caught herself and she goes, no, and Iran is doing it too, but obviously she made a mistake.
But you see, that could be down to the scripted nature of, you're talking about Vladimir Putin. Every year he holds an annual press conference, right? And he sits there, and in the audience, by the way, are BBC, CNN, MSNBC, you know, when Joe Biden or Donald Trump, you know, gives his very scripted thing in
asking,
the Rose Garden.
By the way, asking combative questions.
Yeah. We're not in the Rose Garden. We're not even allowed into the country. We're not even into the airport. We're not even allowed broadcast it. So this shows something. But interestingly, Dorothy Shea, guess where she was a U.S. ambassador?
I bet it was someplace close to Israel.
Lebanon. So maybe there's some subliminal absorption in this terrible Freudian slip she's made. It could be kind of career-ending stuff, right? You know? So it really defines something, right? That she's been in Lebanon working as the U.S. ambassador. Maybe some truth is seeping through.
I was just going to say, let me ask you the question here. She accidentally said the truth out loud.
Yeah, she said the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
Now, Joe Biden...
You're not supposed to say Israel's starting
Joe Biden did it too. He introduced Vladimir Zelensky on stage. He said, you know, President Putin. You know, he said, people often sort of say this, even a Ukrainian commentator, sometimes they accidentally say, you know, President Putin, President of Ukraine.
Yeah.
This is very famously when Zelensky, you know... But Biden said the president of Ukraine, Mr. Putin, you know,
and Bush when he said when he got Iraq and Ukraine mixed up.
Yeah, it seeps through. It seeps through. It subliminally, it just pops out, you know.
All right. So a lot of other things that you and I should talk about, and I think it is important. And I do want to underscore the fact that the Russian economy is, can't say it's back, but it certainly is showing. I mean, if you think about it, go back to the 1990s, and I think Mr. Putin said this in his statement. When you go back to the 1990s, the unemployment rate in this country was something like 21%. Mm-hmm. 21% unemployment. Since then, they've pulled it back to something like 9%, now 7%, and they're aiming for 5%. That's actually competitive with the situation in the United States, because in the United States, the way we do the unemployment there is we don't include anybody who stopped looking for a job 6 months ago. So if you haven't stopped looking for a job, you're not in the stats. So even though our unemployment is around 4.5%, Russia's is 7%, it's probably pretty close, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you got to remember as well, in Russia, when Vladimir Putin took power, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that's seen as almost an apocalyptic period in Russian history.
Yeah.
Lots of things. Remember, a lot of people who were born in the Soviet Union, their country disappeared overnight.
Yeah.
Imagine that. The currency disappeared, pensions, life savings were gone, and Vladimir Putin had to step into this void. And even Western leaders begrudgingly will say, you know, this man basically saved Russia. And the Russians understand that. And he had to do it with tough love. There was a lot of tough love. He had to take on a lot of very powerful people, a lot of oligarchs. And, you know, what's really interesting, Rick, is a lot of the people who are behind this movement in the West, this Russian independent, this Russian opposition, just so happened to be the guys that Mr. Putin kind of ran out of town when they wouldn't play ball with actually reforming Russia. And interesting, something we talked about is the first part of his talk here at SPIEF, it is an economic conference, right? So you've got to talk about economics,
of course,
you know? And we're kind of political animals. So the economic stuff can be a bit, you know,
right.
Come on, let's get on to the bigger issues. But he's the president of the Russian Federation. And the people in Russia are concerned, just like we are back home in the West, about trains running on time, schools, what are people getting? He actually mentioned that Russian wages aren't as high as he'd like them to be. He's talking about, you know, getting the poverty rate down, which is very low, below 5%, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still, to the international audience, he's this man, he's this figure, this globally prominent figure, but he still has to do the housework. He still has to work here as the president. He's still in charge of all these different departments and ordinary Russian life, and he's delivered huge improvements in Russia for ordinary Russians too.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, and I was having a conversation earlier with the head of the Chamber of Commerce of Latin America in Russia, because as you know, Russia has a flourishing relationship these days with Latin America. And you know, he mentioned to me that consumerism in Russia is one of the most attractive things to the countries in Latin America, because they want to be able to put their products here and they want to take advantage of the fact that there are these sanctions so that Russians can actually buy products from countries like Venezuela, for example, and Mexico and other countries. But the interesting thing is Russia, population-wise, is not a huge country. It's not, when compared to China and Indonesia and India. And however, there's very little poverty in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So they may only have 160 million people, but there are 160 million consumers. It's not you have a billion people, but only 400,000 of them actually consume. Mm-hmm. It's 160 million people and 160 million people who are rabid about buying products,
mm-hmm.
and they've always enjoyed buying Western products and would love to have them back.
Yeah, for sure. And Russia has a huge middle class now. Remember, because after communism, Russia became so. You know, you probably get this too. You know, you're in Russia; they're communists. People, you know, you get this occasionally. I go to people: what are you talking about?
Yes.
I mean, Russia is probably the most aggressively capitalist country on earth. Maybe even more so than the United States.
Yeah, in many ways, you do get that feeling.
Yeah, so there's that rebound effect, and Russians, you know, here in Russia, we can get almost everything we need probably quicker and faster than we can in the West. So it's quite remarkable, this narrative, which is, you know, deployed against Russia.
President Putin was talking about that. He just mentioned in his speech that there are 77,000 new Russian brands that have been established over the last year through 2024.
For sure.
And as a result, the entrepreneurship rate is up 12%. So they're pushing. He said in his speech, interestingly enough, and he said he wants more young people who are Russians to try and establish businesses. And he wants them, interestingly enough, and I'm going to use a word I don't usually use as a journalist, he wants them to breed. He said the average young person has a baby and he wants those salary conditions to increase so that they can have a baby. And then he said, maybe two.
Yeah.
Maybe three.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's he getting at? Well, what is he getting at there?
The reality in Russia is no different to any other developed country. There's a population crisis. We are not having enough babies, Rick.
Yeah.
Not you and I personally.
Well, no, in most Western countries. Yeah. Japan is worse.
Japan is on the verge of a population collapse.
Yeah.
Which used to be, remember, Japan used to be the absolute dynamo of industry in Asia.
Okay, yeah.
Huge. Europe is on the same cusp.
Right.
So Russia, in Hungary, for example, Mr. Orban has basically made it a reality that a woman who wants to stay at home, mind kids, and raise a family never pays income tax.
Mm.
Okay. So it's come to the point in Europe where some countries, one of the more common sense ones being Hungary, on many issues, are deciding that we have to actually get involved in people's lives to stimulate a growth in population. Russia is no different. Russia also has, remember, a lot of migrants moving around, coming to the big population centers from the old Soviet Union.
Mm.
And they're essential to growth, but they also bring some socioeconomic problems when they arrive, too. So Russia's doing huge work on this, on trying to be pragmatic about working with migrants. And there's so many common sense things about how Russia's doing business around immigration, which we just can't seem to replicate in the West. We can't seem to actually say at the border, you got to actually show your passport, you got to get an X-ray, you got to get a HIV test.
No.
You got to do all these things because you're a migrant.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Sense.
I mean, I've only been here a month or so, but from what I've seen from a efficiency standpoint, from a technological efficiency standpoint, in many ways, I see things here that I wish I would see in my own country.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to use cards, essentially, to get things done immediately. Even tips here are usually paid with your phone, whereas you don't have to be doing the math.
Yeah.
Since for those of us who are writers and don't know how to do math. Can we go back to Ukraine?
Mm-hmm.
I want to play, and I think you have this, guys, in the control room. Gene, this is President Putin talking about the situation now in Ukraine. Remember, and let me just kind of set the table for you. In many ways, what's going on in Ukraine now is Russia, because Ukraine and Russia have not been able to come to some kind of compromise where they can come up with a peace deal, Russia's military has continued to move forward and forward and forward. There are reports today that there was some kind of attacks taking place in Odessa, the specifics of which we don't know, but it now looks like there's some kind of movement in Odessa in terms of what Russian troops are doing. So there's a consistent pattern of this not looking good for the Ukrainian side and looking quite good for the Russian military as they continue to move through. The question then is, what is the ultimate solution or what's the end game for Russia? Because a lot of people around the world want to know, if the war were to stop tomorrow, how much of that territory belongs to Russia? How much of that territory belongs to Ukraine, for example? Well, in many ways, you kind of hear the answer to that in this question that was posed to Vladimir Putin about how much of that land will be belonging to Ukraine. Now, remember, he's speaking somewhat metaphorically. I want you to listen to his words. He speaks somewhat metaphorically because Vladimir Putin always has a way of wanting to, like many Russians do this, by the way. They have a very rich history, and they tie things to history an awful lot. So his answer has historic overtones, but listen to what he says about what Russia's actions so far mean and would mean in Ukraine. Here it is.
But you know, we have an old saying. Well, it's not exactly a proverb or a parable, but an ancient rule. Wherever the foot of a Russian soldier steps, that is ours. You mentioned the areas in Ukraine that we consider our own. I have said many times that I consider the Russian and Ukrainian people to be one people, in fact. In this sense, the whole of Ukraine is ours. We proceed from the realities that are developing. Of course, there are people, many of them in the neighboring country, who strive to ensure their sovereignty and independence. And good luck to them. By the way, we have never questioned the right of the Ukrainian people to independence and sovereignty. From the very beginning, when the conflict had already reached an acute level, we suggested then-Ukrainian leadership immediately to stop all conflicts and withdraw troops from those territories where people do not want to live as part of Ukraine. They refused.
So he's saying, look, we went in, we took, we keep it. And where Russian soldiers' boots on the ground go, we stay. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, it's an old Russian saying, so he's somewhat speaking metaphorically. But then he continues to say, we would respect the sovereignty and the independence of Ukraine. However, when they cross the line and they're not sovereign and independent, then we have to go in. And once we go in, we ain't getting out. That's what I heard. What did you hear?
Yeah, and the context is always important. And our viewers in the West and back home need to understand that most of these parts were, you know, Malorussia. This was originally part of the Russian Empire.
Yeah.
Many scholars and educated people who talk about this stuff. You remember Tucker's interview with Vladimir Putin where he gave him this big history lesson at the start.
They're still talking about it.
People,
Tucker's still talking about it.
But still, it's still important because background is everything. People need to understand that most of these territories, Odessa is a city you mentioned, which was built by Catherine the Great. There was nothing there. And in modern day Ukraine, the idea of Ukraine as well, many people would say that Vladimir Lenin was the man who actually decided, let's create Ukraine. Ukraine meaning on the edge. So there is a narrative, but even with that, and even with this sort of historical reality, Vladimir Putin in here today turns around and says, look, we don't deny anybody their sovereignty, but they're not sovereign. Basically, what's happening now is they've basically essentially sold their country.
Yeah.
They're not in charge. Anyway, look, is Vladimir Zelensky, is he actually the president elected in 2019 to end the war, end corruption? And we're probably 7 years into a five-year presidency, no elections, you know.
But let me press you a little bit on this, because you've been covering this thing for a long time. Hell, you've been there, right? Let's suppose Russia goes to the Dnieper River and beyond, and even reaches as far as Odessa, as we're getting some reports, confirmed or unconfirmed at this point, that they do. And then let's suppose finally, a month after that, this war finally ends, and Mr. Trump and Mr. Zelensky or whoever, the Hungary or whoever sits down, and or the Turks, and they come up with a peace deal. Does Russia keep Odessa, all the land, Donetsk, all the land all the way up to the Dnieper River? Do you expect that that would be the solution, or would they give something back?
Well, look, at the core, from what we hear from the American side about the deal, Mr. Kellogg was talking about, was the fact you keep what you hold. What you hold, you keep.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ukrainians...
It's always the way it's been historically.
Yeah, it's always been the way it's been. And we heard also mentioned here about Korea. There's Korea, North and South Korea are still at war, essentially. Right. There hasn't been a peace deal, but there is peace, if you like, across this international peace line.
Right.
The problem for, I think, for Moscow and for the Russian side is they don't want their kids and grandkids to have to fight this war again. And I think there's a sense, we've seen when Trump came into power, we saw this idea, I'm going to end the war in 24 hours. I don't think anybody serious thought that was going to happen. I think that was, in some ways, theater, that the intention would be to get and start the process to end it. But the Russians now, I think, basic strategy and basic reality is no deal is better than a bad deal.
Yes.
Remember, the Russians are advancing day by day, village after village.
Yes.
Of course, Ukraine may be off the mainstream agenda right now, but while that's happening, there's a vast army encroaching slowly, slowly. There's less and less of Ukraine to argue about the longer this goes on.
And Mr. Putin mentioned, in fact, that they may end up taking Sumy and keeping it as well. He said it's a possibility. I'm not going to say we are, but you know what? That's part of that buffer zone that you were talking about.
Sumy was the hub from which this catastrophic invasion.
Of course.
Told, you know, the Western media were telling us, oh, you're going to have an invasion. The Russians have been invaded by the Ukrainians. I mean, Kursk is a single oblast. The Ukrainians only ever actually controlled a fraction of a percent of the Russian Federation, which is a continental landmass. But the media feeds into this thing, and then the media doesn't seem to want to report that they got their, you know, asses handed to them, and they were pushed right back out. And now Mr. Putin has decided we're going to go to the beehive and we're going to sort that problem out because we're not going to do this again.
Yeah, just to make sure that
that's
they can't
basically
gather
the analogy.
By the way, going back to the story you mentioned about Tucker's interview with Mr. Putin, I asked Tucker about that. I said, dude, what was going on with you? I mean, you asked him the question and he talked for like an hour. Why didn't you, like, at least, you know, get in there and try and, you know, do what you would do with the nails? And Tucker says to me, he says, Rick, because we were using this translator, I was so confused, and I never figured out the whole translation thing. So the translator kind of made me crazy, and I didn't know what was going on, and I couldn't hear. So I got a couple of weeks ago, when I went to do an interview with Medinsky, I remembered Tucker's advice, and the first thing I did is I said, I want to hear the translator, I want to have a conversation, and I want somebody sitting here talking because I want to be able to practice, because I'd never use, you know, we don't use translators.
Yeah, for sure.
Western media, we only talk to ourselves. We don't talk to anybody else. Yeah. So I remember I prepared, thinking of what Tucker went through with Putin was the reason that I was able to do an okay interview with Medinsky, because I got prepared myself.
It was great.
Thanks so much. All right. Next thing we have to talk about, Putin on the economy. Mm-hmm. He today started by trying to assure the Russian people and really the allies, because one of the things that I think we need to underscore is this economic forum, this is not a Russian economic forum. This is an economic forum for the Global South community. So, I mean, I was in a, I was asked to moderate a conference this morning on the economic conditions, especially when it comes to energy for many of these countries. And I was moderating a conversation between the officials from the energy and ministers from India, Japan, China, Qatar, Indonesia, and Venezuela. So this is not about the economy of Russia. This is about the economy of most of these very powerful countries in the Global South community. And you saw just a little while ago, Mr. Putin sitting with Indonesia, Bahrain, China, and South Africa. So that's kind of been the spirit of what's going on here. So what Mr. Putin is trying to do when he came out today at the plenary session, as they call it, which basically just means the last important speech they give before they close this thing down, is essentially the scorecard. Here's where we are, here's where we're going, here's where we come. So here's Putin now talking about the economy at the very beginning of this speech. Go ahead and get that for him, Gene, if you got it.
The perception of the Russian economy as exclusively resource-based and dependent on hydrocarbon exports is clearly outdated. These stereotypes are fading into the past. Reality tells a different story. Russia now ranks fourth in the world in terms of gross domestic product and first in Europe. According to statistics, annual inflation has already decreased to single-digit figures of less than 10%. As of June 16th, it stood at 9.6%. Of course, this is still high, but inflation targeting continues. In the first 4 months of this year, Russia's GDP increased by 1.5% year over year, with growth accelerating to 1.9% in April. By the end of the first quarter of this year, compared to the same figure a year ago, the number of citizens with incomes below the poverty line had decreased by more than 2 million people. Representatives from the Russian side of our meeting today know this, but I will repeat it for our guests. In 2000, the poverty rate in the Russian Federation was 29%. In what was, frankly, a humiliating situation, we had 42.3 million people affected. By the end of 2024, this figure was not 29%, but 7.2%. And it wasn't 42.3 million people, it was 10.5 million people.
It's not a perfectly rosy picture, and to be honest with you, there's news on this front too, because one of the finance ministers in Russia today also said, look, there's a possibility that we could be looking at a recession in Russia over the next year, and he was just being straight about the situation, widely reported, by the way. I'm not breaking news here. But nonetheless, the picture that we heard coming out of this forum, let me just put it in these terms. Compare that to what we're seeing in France, what we're seeing in the UK, and what we're seeing in Germany.
Yeah. I mean, Germany, right? The beating heart of Europe's economy. After the Second World War, which, of course, you know, who won the Second World War? That's another day's
discussion,
right?
Well, obviously, Normandy.
Yeah, of course.
America.
It was won on June the 6th. By the way, in Leningrad, which is the city we're in, it used to be called St. Petersburg, built by Peter the Great, 1701, on a swamp.
Look at you, knowing all this
Russian history. Yeah, but he traveled around.
Not bad for an Irish guy.
Yeah, he traveled around Europe. He saw how beautiful it was, and he basically built Vienna, Paris, London, here in St. Petersburg. An incredible city. But getting back to it, it used to be called, of course, St. Petersburg after him, some say, but after St. Peter, I think it was after him. And then in the Second World War, a catastrophic siege took place in this city, right?
Right.
Talking about D-Day and who won the war. We won the war. We're going to have a parade, Mr. Trump, right? In Leningrad itself, a city, by the way, where Vladimir Putin grew up,
yeah,
more people died in this city, in Leningrad, during the siege of Leningrad than the entire combined war dead of the United States and the United Kingdom combined. Can you imagine that? Vladimir Putin's own brother, before he died of diphtheria in this city. He's buried here.
Wow.
So this is a personal thing. When people talk about during the 6th, we won the war, it's very personal for the Russians. It's a living history, okay? So when we talk about economy and growth in the economy, that's also important too, because like we say, it's about housekeeping. Ordinary Russians aren't shy, as you know, about talking about politics, about talking about wanting to get things done,
but improving things. But when you get to really the, and I don't mean to interrupt you because you're bigger than me and I don't want to make you mad, but the when you think of GDP growth, few things are more important than GDP growth when you study what's going on in any particular country's economy over the span of, like, let's say one fiscal year. And when you look at GDP growth, I think Russia's somewhere around 3.6, which ain't bad for a country that's one of the most, you know, punished, economically punished, sanctioned countries in the world. It shouldn't grow at all.
It shouldn't be growing.
And but Germany is not growing at all.
And again, Germany's energy, the point I wanted to make before I went off into Leningrad was
that... It's been a long day.
How did the post-war European economy grow? Where did the energy come from? Think about it. Cheap, efficient...
Russian oil
and gas.
Yeah.
And they decapitated that after 22, completely cutting off this supply of oil and gas. Europe's economies are basically tanking purely because they have to buy very expensive LNG from guess where?
But you know what? I'm going to correct you. Don't use words like economy. Who's suffering?
Yeah, ordinary people.
Ordinary people. Yeah, sure. The people of Germany are suffering. Their communities are filled with immigrants who I'm sure are wonderful, wonderful people who had to leave their countries and were forced out and ended up in Germany because NATO decided to destroy their countries.
Yeah.
So they end up in Germany. Now the Germans have a horrible situation where they're unhappy. By the way, their wages are down 5-7%.
And bills are up.
30%. And they can't buy oil. Yeah. Because they have to buy American oil, which is three times more expensive than Russian oil. I don't know the number, and I apologize for using a number I don't know. But when you really look at that situation, you do have to ask yourself, and this is something, you know, going back to some of the folks that I trust, the people who I read. When I read, when I study the news, when I look for sources, I look for people who are pushing for something that I believe is more important in this world than anything else. Freedom. Mm-hmm. Freedom, true freedom, knowing things, and taking care of your own community.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I see that is a lacking in places like Starmer, for example. The other day he was asked by a reporter, cross my heart, he was asked by a reporter, Mr. Starmer, if our country, the UK, ends up in a war with Iran and India, I mean Israel, pardon me, the people are going to be hurting again. And you know what that guy said? You know what Starmer told him? He said, yes, just like they were hurt when we had to do what we did in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we just have to mitigate these things.
Yeah.
So he was literally saying, admitting the quiet part out loud, like you like to say, that, sure, it sucks to be a resident of the UK or Great Britain at a time when we decide that we're going to go fight a war that most of my citizens couldn't find on a map. Tough luck.
Yeah, and remember, Starmer arrived, he was the most unpopular new prime minister in the history of the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
That, okay? Now, he, one of his first policy decisions was to cut the old age pensioners' fuel allowance for winter. Now, the British Medical Association society groups came out and said 4,000 people are going to die because of this.
Right.
He refused to reverse it. In the same week, he came out and said, we're going to sign a 100-year deal with Vladimir Zelensky in Ukraine. A 100-year partnership. You know, where are we going to be in 100 years? The problem, to get back to what you're talking about cutting off gas.
Why would
gas,
he do that?
Why?
I've never...
Because they hate...
You're European.
They hate Russia. for some remarkable reason, but in the
British case,
it's hundreds of years old. In Afghanistan, 200 years ago, the British went to war with the Afghans because they believed that the Russians were going to come in and attack India.
But think about what you're saying. You're saying we are willing to punish our people and let them eat dirt rather than have a relationship or buy oil from Russia.
They hate and fear Russia more than they love their own people. And that's the same for the EU as it is for the UK, because there's no rational reality. You go down any high street in the UK, or you go anywhere in Europe. I've traveled all over Europe, and I'm saying to people, what do you think of the Russians? Oh, we like the Russians. I can't seem to find these people who are terrified of Russia. We were told a week ago by Kaja Kallas, basically, that in 2027, Kaja Kallas, EU's foreign policy chief, top diplomat in the EU, she says we're going to completely cut off Russian energy in 2027, just like that. She just says that. Now, yesterday I was at a meeting here with Peter Szijjártó, the Russian foreign minister, or the Hungarian foreign minister.
Yeah.
We cannot afford to cut off Russian oil and gas here. We had people from the UAE and Qatar saying, look, we're going to have hundreds of millions of people in the global south who are going to be completely reliable on fossil fuels. The reality may be in Northern Europe, in Norway and Sweden, and all these very wealthy Scandinavian countries that we can have little windmills that are going to power our iPhones. The reality is there's a massive population boom. As we talked about, our dying populations in Europe and North America, the only place that the populations are growing are in the south. Big countries like Indonesia, a country with a vast population, 285 million people in Indonesia. Newsflash. That man is here, as you know. Mm-hmm. We heard him speaking earlier on. You know, he's here to do business with Russia.
The people of Ireland, the people of England, the people of Wales and Scotland, the people of Germany, the people of France, the people of America, my country, they're good people. They're good people. They don't know that they're being lied to. There's this, you know, and that's where I feel bad. You know, I happen to be a Christian, and I just believe that, you know, with truth, you know, I think Jesus may have said something about this, is what brings freedom. And when you don't give people the truth and you do things based on war or greed or money or weapon sales, you know, you're really cheating your own people. And I think if there's a discovery phase or stage that we in the world, I think, are going through, it's that. I'm seeing it and hoping it continues in the West, specifically in the United States, more, by the way, than in the European countries, where we are seeing an alternative media stand up and say, wait a minute, why do we have to go fight in Iran because Israel decides that they want us to?
Yeah.
And this is a legitimate question that's being asked mostly by the right in the United States right now. The people who put Donald Trump in power are saying, why the hell are we fighting in Ukraine, and why the hell are we going to go fight a war with Iran?
Yeah.
And it's a legitimate question.
Yeah, of course. And we've seen this movie before, Rick. You remember Colin Powell sitting in the UN with his little file of talking powder or whatever it was in there? Because it sure wasn't anything to do with weapons of mass destruction. That war took the lives of probably a million people. A lot of Americans died. A lot of American soldiers are still killing themselves. You know, dozens of U.S. veterans from that war are dying by suicide a year. Dozens, hundreds in many cases. So these wars, the war in Afghanistan, these are wars of, you know, complicity in this rules-based order, which basically means we make up the rules and we give the orders. You know, General Wesley Clark very famously said, he was walking through the Pentagon, and he was called into an office and said, oh, you know what we're doing next week, don't you, sir? He said, what? And we're gonna invade Iraq. Why are we going to invade Iraq? I don't know, because the people in the White House reckon we got a big army, we need to bomb somebody. And we're going to bomb, I think, 7 countries in 5 years.
I wish it was the people in the White House.
It's crazy. And we've now seen them being ticked off the list. They're getting ticked off the list one by one. Nothing happens by accident.
By the way, speaking of that, there was a lot of pressure being put on President Putin during this news conference. And where he was being asked, are you letting Iran down? Isn't it your responsibility to stand up to the West? Iran has been loyal to you. You've been loyal to them. What are you going to do about this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he answered the question, but you can tell that, pardon me for saying this, but Putin's in a bit of a pickle right now. Because he wants, and I think you're the one who caught this, and I think we made a note of it, but you said, listen to what he just said right there. I don't know if you remember, but he was trying to say that, yes, here it is, I found it. This is your quote, because while we were watching this, you said, Rick, write that down, and I did. He said, we always meet our obligations, and we will meet our obligations when it comes to Iran. Mm-hmm. Because he's being asked directly, you know, what are you going to do about this? I mean, if the United States attacks or something, he says, we will always do what we need to do, but we have a lot of things going on, relations with longstanding relations with Israel, as well as the restoration, your words, the restoration of relations with the U.S. What's he trying to say?
Yeah, well, we've been hearing this week that Russia canceled a meeting. Maria Zakharova, who sat with you here,
yes.
Great interview. She mentioned that there'd been a postponement or a cancellation, and of course the Western media goes insane that it's all fallen apart. But today, an hour ago, Mr. Putin said the restoration, to continue the restoration. So Ukraine is a huge issue in Russia. It's a huge issue in Europe. It's a huge global issue.
Yeah.
But there is a bigger issue, and the bigger issue is detente between Russia, this superpower, and America, this
yes.
superpower. And on the Russian side, you've got China sitting in the background, big brother on your eastern eastern flank. So this is a big chess game. And the big game in town, the only game in town, is essentially how Russia and America reach that detente, start to work together. Because remember, Trump's a businessman. He wants to do business.
Yeah.
Russia
yeah.
is the most resource-rich country on planet Earth. It's a continental landmass.
But my dear friend, what happens, Che, if the United States starts shooting missiles into Iran?
Mm-hmm.
What does China do? What does Russia do?
Yeah.
What do the rest of these allies of Iran?
Well, Russia doesn't have a military pact with Iran, a mutual defense pact. So they're not military allies, as far as I'm aware, and as someone can correct me, I stand to be corrected, but I don't think they are. Different scenario to Syria as well. And again, without Syria, without regime change occurring in Syria, Mr. Jalani taken over from Bashar al-Assad, there's no way the Israelis would have been able to conduct this operation.
But I bet the Iranians are sitting around going, boy, there's a deterrence here.
Yeah.
I hope the Americans must be thinking, let's not do that, because remember, these guys are friends with China and Russia and India and South Africa and all these other global South or BRICS countries. I mean, I don't know. We don't know how this is going
to
play out.
Russia doesn't have an obligation to militarily intervene with Iran, okay? I don't think it's good for Russia if Iran is destabilized to the point it becomes another Syria. Of course it's not. But I also don't think that President Trump wants to get involved in a shooting war in Iran. Remember, geostrategically, Iran is very difficult to invade. Boots on the ground are not going to happen in Iran. Iran has built a vast network of underground missile capabilities. It's well able to defend itself. And this war could drag on much longer than Israel believed it was going to do. So I think we have to kind of cool our boots a bit and say, look, does Trump really want to get involved in another Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran? You'd know better than me.
There's a lot of military experts that I speak to, Douglas McGregor being one of them, who are convinced that the United States doesn't have the means right now to be able to, or the experience to support a military that would be able to fashion an offensive in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And what they say is, and you have to ask yourself this, Che, I mean, let's just talk logic here. The United States did not win in Iraq. Did not win in Afghanistan.
When did the United States last win a war?
World War II. Wait, no, I covered one.
Yeah.
Grenada.
Yeah, Grenada.
There were like 20 sheep there. We beat them.
Yeah.
Don't laugh. Yeah. You're absolutely right. The last time the United States had actually a very successful mission,
well,
you could say the first part of the Iraq War.
Yeah.
But
the pathology of how those wars started is here again.
Correct.
We're being told they're days away from a bomb, minutes away from a bomb. We're 45 minutes away from attack with Iraq, with Saddam Hussein. Really? I mean, Tulsi Gabbard has something different to say.
Well, she says they don't have nuclear weapons and they don't have a nuclear weapons program that's worth attacking. Let me go to G7. So G7 took place in Canada. Mr. Trump showed up. Mr. Trump laughed. Mr. Trump said, why are we G7? It should be G8. Russia should be involved. And he basically said...
See Mark Carney's face when he said that?
He threw him out.
It was beautiful.
Mr. Trump basically said, look... I know, the cameramen are mad at me because I keep covering you up. Sorry, my laptop. I'm going to get a smaller one. Mr. Trump basically said, every time I'm with you guys, all you do is talk about Russia, 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 Russia. If you're going to talk about him, why don't you just invite him here and have him talk? Why talk about them when you could talk to them? Which I thought, you know, every once in a while, Donald Trump, for all his craziness, has some brilliant stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, he's great. He's great.
He was right on the money. But what I wanted to play for you at home is this. This is Sabiunto, right? Did I pronounce his name right?
I'm going to... Subianto.
Subianto. He is the leader of Indonesia, the president of Indonesia. And he's speaking a while ago behind us here with Vladimir Putin. And he says, I could have chosen to go to the G7, but I chose to come here. Which I know, just from a significant standpoint, I think it's important. I want you to hear it. Gene, if you could, pick this one up. Cut five.
I was asked why I did not attend the G7, but... I attended the St. Petersburg Forum 2025. And it's not because I did not respect the G7. It's because I gave my commitment to attend this forum before they invited me. So that's the only reason. So... please don't read too much into the event. Sometimes political observers, they want to read, is this a political statement, right? No. Indonesia, by tradition, always non-aligned. We respect all countries. Our foreign policy is very simple. One phrase, 1,000 friends, too few. One enemy, too many. We want to be friends with everybody.
Mm-hmm. He's trying to be very diplomatic and say, look, they invited me first. But let's be serious. We all know the score here. It used to be that, you know, the G7 and these other factions inside the Western countries, they were the most important, the most covered events in the world. Everybody flocked there. Everybody wanted to be seen there. It was the place to be. Mm-hmm. Not so much anymore. Mm-hmm. It you know, BRICS is becoming a hotter ticket than the G7.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, even though I know he's trying to disguise it, I think it proves it. And his story doesn't really hold water. It's almost like, look, Jay, we could go to a Little League football game, or I could take you to the Super Bowl. And you're going to say, well, I just happened to choose the Super Bowl because they invited me first. Bull crap.
Yeah.
You know, I know what this means to you. And I think that's what's happening here.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, look, when it comes to countries like Indonesia, right, we don't know enough about them in the West, okay? And we are in silos in the West, in Europe. Europe has about 745 million people lives in it, okay? It's always been the center of everything.
Say that number again?
745 million.
That's all?
The population, basically, of the entirety of Europe.
Not even a billion?
Yeah, not even a
billion. Really?
Indonesia...
that surprises me.
Get this, has 285 million people living in it. And the president of that country was here today. One of how many? 140...
it's almost half a year.
...countries
are
here. And they're here to do business. I mean...
India.
The numbers on what the deals are signed. And again, it's about growth. These are countries that are experiencing huge growth. They need to power these economies. China, the biggest manufacturing economy on earth. What happened to the trade war with China? It seemed to just fall off the radar. Mm. So let's go to war with Iran. And remember, you talk about these elites, G7. Guess who met in Switzerland recently? You can correct me if I'm wrong about Switzerland. The Bilderberg Group, in complete secrecy, very powerful, very clandestine group. They meet, and suddenly we're on a different path geostrategically. Suddenly things have changed. What happened to the trade war with China? China is here. It's the biggest population center along with China on earth. So the biggest populations, the biggest economies, the growing economies, the only game in town is the South. The Europeans know it. The Americans know it. So how do you distract from the coming economic crisis? Rick, what do you need?
Yeah, you need a...
over there.
You need a war. Yeah, you need a war. BRICS is really, really manifesting itself. And I think, you know, I've been covering BRICS for many years, obviously, because I've been doing the news at RT, and it's a subject you hear a lot about. Although, I'll be honest with you, you walk around the streets of America, nobody knows what the hell BRICS is. Mm-hmm. You know, I was holding a seminar the other day, and I asked some, and it was freedom of speech and BRICS.
and there were all the BRICS countries were represented there. And I asked them, and I basically said, you know, I'm not sure you guys are doing a very good job selling yourself because you're talking too much to yourself. You need to talk to the West. The West doesn't know what BRICS is at this point. Do they really know BRICS in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, BRICS, I think BRICS has been seen traditionally as something reactionary because Russia wanted to build a club with its friends. But BRICS started to grow. And remember, during the election process, Mr. Trump started to talk about...
But if you stop the average person in Great Britain, in Ireland, Scotland, Wales,
you know,
whatever...
They think BRICS are something you build a house with.
Exactly.
I would imagine.
And you said, what is BRICS? Would they know?
But that's because of the client media. Like, I was tweeting today about, and the last few days, about here in St. Petersburg. I mean, people don't know this is happening. Can you imagine that?
Right.
Can you imagine how controlling the media is in the West, that this vast meeting here...
should be here.
Billions of deals happening. Of course they should be here. And it goes back to what Maria Zakharova said right in this chair. She said, we'll preserve Europe for when the Europeans realize they've screwed up so badly that they got to come to St. Petersburg to see what one of their cities used to look like.
And that's why guys like you and I mean, look, you know, I ain't the bravest guy in the world, but I do believe in free speech, and I do believe that truth should be told. I'm not here to, you know, kiss anybody's butt. I'm here to basically tell the truth about what's going on in the world. And if this is an important part of the world, then its truth deserves to be told as well. Mm-hmm. Just like the truth of the United States and the truth of Great Britain and the truth of everybody else deserves to be. How can you avoid half of the story and look at yourself in the mirror and say you told the whole story?
Yeah, it's just like Kaja Kallas saying, in 2027, we're going to cut off all Russian energy. We don't care. It's like Ms. Baerbock in Germany saying, we don't care what our voters say.
Yeah.
We're going to give the money to Ukraine. It's like the generals in NATO saying, the Russians are going to attack us in 5 years' time. We don't know where. We don't know how. We got no evidence. But it's the narrative has to. It's almost a pseudo-religious narrative because they've got nothing of substance. Here, they're talking about cooperation, collaboration, building. In the West, at the G7, they're talking about how to stop trade, how to stop collaboration. Think about it.
Yeah.
Two very different sides, the dark side of the moon. Here, it's about building. There, it's about restricting trade. Think about that. Imagine that.
Here is Mr. Putin, the president of Russia, who I was surprised he could sit there for 4 hours. The man is 72 years old and didn't have to go to the bathroom. here he is speaking about BRICS. Boom. Take it, Gene.
Yes, in the beginning.
At the beginning of the 21st century, the BRICS countries accounted for 1/5 of the global economy. Today, that figure has risen to 40% of the global economy. It is clear that this share will continue to grow. This will happen inevitably, primarily due to the dynamic states of the global South. We need this growth to become increasingly sustainable and to encompass as many countries as possible. For this, a fundamentally new development model is required, one that is not based on the rules of neocolonialism, where the so-called golden billion extracts resources from other countries. What we need is a new development model that is free from political manipulation and takes into account the national interests of states. At the BRICS summit held last autumn in Kazan, 35 countries representing nearly 2/3 of the world's population and half of the global economy expressed a common understanding of the approaches necessary for a future world. Even today, BRICS countries are setting the standard in the development of so-called human-centered industries, launching major projects to improve the living environment. Of course, we are paying special attention to strengthening ties within BRICS. The mutual trade turnover between our countries has already exceeded $1 trillion and continues to grow.
We've got about another 10 or 12 minutes before we shut this party down, and I've got some really great things I want to show you, but I do want to get your reaction to this. I get a sense that Putin is asserting himself, or no, that's the wrong word. He's not asserting himself. He is wearing or starting to be seen as the guy who wears the mantle as the leader of BRICS by the other member nations on BRICS. And I don't think it's because he wants it. I think it's because the circumstances have kind of put him there, mostly the situation with the sanctions, for example. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that assessment, or am I full of crap?
It's absolutely correct. And why? Let's think about why. Countries like South Africa under huge pressure for doing business with BRICS, for wanting to trade in their own countries. Remember, the oil that greases U.S. hegemony around the world has always been the U.S. dollar. Always been the U.S. dollar. Yeah. You control a country's economy. You control their geostrategic, geopolitical life. It's easy. The French did it across the Sahel and
Africa. It's currency.
The French franc. The U.S. have done it. It's been good business. But a threat to the U.S. dollar's hegemony and dominance is a real threat to the U.S. economy's dominance. So Mr. Putin has weathered these sanctions. I think there's over 30,000 sanctions in place. We're going into the 18th sanctions package. You got to ask yourself, what were the first ones about? If we're at 18,
I forgot.
You know what I mean?
Now, like, now we're sanctioning the cleaning guy over here.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's like Kaja Kallas says, we don't need dependency on Russian oil. A dead guy doesn't need any oxygen either, but he's still a dead guy, okay? So it's this absolutely insane narrative that when will the EU say, okay, look, it hasn't worked. I'll tell you when, not likely, because so much political, financial capital has been invested by people like von der Leyen,
right,
by people like the Democrats in the US. Trump had a great vacuum to step into and say, look, we got it wrong. Maybe we should pull back. We're going to do business. We're still hearing those very positive whispers from Trump because he's a businessman. He wants to do business. He knows the potential here.
I think you're right. I think Mr. Trump gets it, and he knows as well when it comes to business, if you have a product, that product will sell.
Yeah.
Russia has oil, lots of oil, probably the best oil, the best system for extracting oil, some of the best natural gas. Someone's going to want that somewhere.
Yeah.
So you can't like pretend, oh, no, they don't have it. Of course they have it.
And the BRICS countries
and
are looking.
China and India will buy it.
They're looking at Putin and saying, look, this guy's here. He's exceptionally popular. So why wouldn't he be the unofficial leader of BRICS? Because they look to Russia and say, if Russia can make it through and grow and be stronger and we can be under that umbrella, who else is going to be in charge?
Let's talk about the other side of the coin, and I almost feel sorry for him right now. Not so much Mr. Trump, because in many ways, as I've said, I respect Mr. Trump. I think compared to other leaders that we've had in the United States, I think he's looking in the right direction, although, you know, he's meeting some very serious obstacles as well. War machine, for example, and, you know, the Zionist, or should I say, and I want to be careful how I say this, because it's, I don't disrespect, you know, Israel, and I think Israel is in many ways a wonderful country. I've been there, I've talked to the people, but the way it's being led right now and the way it's dominating opinion in the United States by buying that opinion just looks bad, and everybody sees it. It's just, it's a story you can't turn away from. But meanwhile, here's Starmer. And this is just a telling moment, and I want you guys to watch this at home. This is Trump and Starmer. They're coming out and announcing that they've got this incredible new trade deal, and it just looks like two guys in charge of a dying empire. Watch.
Okay, thank you very much. We all know the great Prime Minister of the UK, and we just signed a document. This is... Sorry about that.
This is it. A very important document.
Little windy out here. Give me that. We just signed it, and it's done. And so we have our trade agreement with the European Union, and it's a fair deal for both.
It's kind of
You pretty rough, right?
Like, what
short of the bank?
And then Starmer's on his knees. Yeah. Oh, here you go, Mr. Trump.
Is it symbolic? You know, it's symbolic. I mean, you got the head of NATO going into the Oval Office sitting there while Trump says, I'm going to take Greenland. Yeah, you know, I'm going to have a bit of Greenland. You know, of course, belongs to Denmark,
right,
a NATO member, you know, and then he's talking about Canada. I'm going to go into Canada,
yeah,
NATO. So this is...
No, and listen, and I don't want to be that guy either. I hate when the media just picks on moments like that, because I've done stupid things in my life. I do stupid things every day, probably, you know? So I understand that we're all imperfect and anything can happen to anybody, but every once in a while you see these things. Here's another one. Let me show you another one. This is Starmer now.
This is better. This is better.
He's meeting the South Korean president, right?
Go ahead.
You set this up.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, he thinks he's meeting the South Korean president, and he's a man of such, you know, massive global political knowledge, right, Rick? That he embraces and shakes the hand of the translator. I mean, it just doesn't get any better.
And he's the president, and he's like, thank you, sir. Let's take a picture. Here it is. Watch this video.
대통령님 직접 오십시오. 예.
자.
오케이. 저
You and I have been doing this. Yeah, just today I was moderating some events here, and I was real careful because there's a certain protocol. I was meeting ministers from different countries. I sat up last night nervously trying to remember how do you address the guy from here, and what's the formal title for this guy, and then I was looking at pictures and trying to match them. I did a thing today where I had all these people from all these countries. They all looked different to me, and so I made mistakes, by the way, but I really worked hard with our team here to try and know who was who so I could say it right, you know, and I did okay. And still, you're going to make mistakes, but this is one of the most important men in the world, the leader of the government of the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. He looks like an idiot. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but I mean...
Maybe he just doesn't look like one. I mean, if you look at his popularity, he's the most
unpopular. Or did they do that to him on purpose? I mean, do you think they set him up?
It's hard to know, but I mean, in a case like that, if you don't know, don't approach either of them. It's basic field craft, right? If you don't know, you don't approach either. You just wait for them to come to you. So it displays a kind of naivety, you know, but it's all about this falseness about this false engagement. There's no way Mr. Putin is going to do something like that, you know, because he's going to wait until
Well, he's not a perfect guy. Putin makes mistakes, too.
Yeah, but I criticized him. Not on that level.
Yeah, no, I guess you're right. All right, here's another one before we run out of time, because I think these guys want us to shut down at 8 o'clock or at the top of the hour. I know many of you are watching us from around the world. Matt Gaetz, former U.S. congressman from the state of Florida, not a bad guy, by the way, a bit of a truth teller, is now doing a show, and here's what he said. Talk about truth telling. I want you to listen to this. This is what we're going to close on, okay? Boom.
If the world is interested in a secret nuclear program in the Middle East, there is a country that won't allow any international inspectors. Israel. Israel has a nuclear weapon. Did you know that? I do. They allow no inspections. They are fully secretive and clandestine about it. And the Americans are fully aware. You know what? I don't even blame Israel for this. If they want to develop a nuclear weapon, if they had the blessing to do so secretly, I'm not in judgment of that. But to drag the world into a regime change war over secret nuclear weapons, when you have secret nuclear weapons, is a bit hypocritical. President Trump is the kind of guy who never gives up on a deal. Throughout his life, he's probably made deals and made lots of money on them, even when others walked away or didn't see value in a transaction. So here's a deal. How about Iran and Israel both give up their secret nuclear weapon programs?
If you have a country that you're going to bomb because they have secret nuclear weapons, shouldn't somebody ask you if you have secret nuclear weapons? I mean, can you say boom?
Yeah, well, look, maybe this is the way we should look at it. The only country in human history that ever used a nuclear weapon twice on huge population centers is now telling the rest of the world who can have those weapons. The only guy who ever used them is like the only guy that ever shot anyone in the town decides who can have a gun to protect themselves. Right? Yeah. Get that. And then the guy who pretends he doesn't have the nuclear weapon is going to bomb someone who may have it because they want it to protect themselves from the guy who's pretending he doesn't have it, who's backed by the guy who's the only guy that's ever used it. Get your head around that.
I'm not sure it's logical, but it is what it is. But I think the most significant part of that, and we're down to a minute, I think, is the fact that this is being said out loud in the United States of America. Yeah, this is something, usually I said something similar and I was fired by CNN. Mm-hmm. In the United States, you can't criticize Israel.
Yeah.
And you notice he's couching it, but he's coming pretty close, right?
And I think it's becoming something that you can say out loud, you know. And I think ordinary Americans...
Because of Gaza? Because of the genocide?
Because of Gaza. I think as much as Gaza, because I think ordinary Americans just don't want another war. They don't need another Afghanistan.
No, they don't.
They don't need another Iraq.
No, they
you know
don't.
Better than me.
No, they don't. You're absolutely
they just don't
right.
Want.
I think Mr. Trump is heading into a whale of trouble if he really continues down this path. But McGregor told me and said publicly the other day he feels like he's indebted to the people who gave him money for his campaign, and the people who gave him money for his campaign tend to come from Israel.
AIPAC, look it up.
That was a good conversation. Boy, we held it for an hour. Good job, man. I don't know. Maybe we're going to have a beer or two after this. I'm Rick Sanchez.
This is the Sanchez Effect. It's been a very, very long day here, and well worth it. And I'm glad we were able to stick around and bring you the details of some of the important events that have been taking place here on this day. You can check me out on X at Sanchez TV, and I have a podcast called Journalistically Speaking. And this guy, he's all over the Googles, as they say. Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it. We'll be looking for you again next time.